People have said, you have helped me put words to my grief. You have helped me find language for something I thought was wordless. There's people who join 3 months, 3 years, even 30 years after major losses and come saying, I have not ever had a space or an opportunity to process my grief. It's not just the month after the funeral. It is so much more, so all-encompassing.
You're the kind of person who really opened my eyes to the impact and importance of words and how words can really shift your entire belief system.
Everyone's telling themselves some version of these big three stories. I'm crazy. No one else feels this way. I'm alone. Even in a crowded room, I'm by myself. And then it will be like this forever, or I can't see a way out, or I'm stuck in my grief. These are the things that help gradually get people out of telling themselves these stories.
Have you ever wanted to show up for someone who's grieving, but had no idea what words to use? Today's conversation is for you. I sat down with Shelby Forsythia, grief coach, author, and podcaster, to talk all about her new book, Of Course, I'm Here Right Now. Shelby breaks down what grievers are thinking and feeling and how language can help them better navigate through it. Let's dive into our conversation and give you the tips, tricks, and phrases you need to better support those in your life. I'm Emily Lomenzo-Washkovic, and this is Success Rewritten. And today's guest is Shelby Forsythia. I have a lot of guests on this show that I consider my friends because I've worked with them over the years and done many projects with them. But Shelby and I really are friends who go on vacations together. Anytime I'm in Chicago, I try to tag a little coffee or lunch on with Shelby. So we are real in the flesh friends. And I've been so lucky to follow her and her work and her journey for many years. And I'm so excited she's going to be with us today. Shelby, thank you so much for coming on.
I'm so excited to be here. This is so fun.
It's going to be amazing. Okay. For anyone who doesn't know you, tell us a little bit about yourself. Give us your backstory and your journey to who you are and what brought you to today.
Yeah, so it's a long story, but I often shorten what I do by saying that I'm a grief coach, an author, and a podcaster, and I help people build lives that they genuinely love from the lives that loss forced them to live. So I'm talking about, of course, death-related losses, but also divorce, major diagnosis, job loss, pet loss, estrangement, any significant transition that changes your life and brings upon grief is something that I am trained to help people through, to find words for. And I joke all the time on other podcasts that I don't think anyone ever dreams of becoming like a grief practitioner as a job. Like when you're in kindergarten and people ask you, what do you want to be when you grow up? No one's ever answering, I want to be a grief coach, or I want to be a grief therapist or something like that. And how I came to this work is totally by accident, but my mom died unexpectedly in college. And this was what I refer to as the very worst cherry on top of 4 years of back-to-back losses. They were quiet at first and then kind of built up altogether. But in the 4 years that I was in college, and college had nothing to do with it, but my father lost his job. So our family was for the first time ever in a place of financial instability. Then I came out of the closet as a queer person in the South in a religious family, which was like kind of accepted, but also kind of not. And so there was a lot of touch and go and fighting and like periods of silence there. And then my dad got diagnosed with brain aneurysms, one on either side of his head, and needed to be operated on. And that threw our family into a very scary time of will he live or will he die? And also meal trains, caravans to the hospital, all these people kind of checking in on us and our whole life suddenly revolving around what is happening with his health. And as soon as he came out of his last hospitalization, scans are good, you can start to heal your brain and resume your normal, heavy air quotes around normal life, my mom got diagnosed with breast cancer. And then there was a year and a half of surgeries and tests and chemo and radiation and all of this stuff. And she was declared cancer-free in January 2013. 11 months later, she had something that was like pneumonia adjacent. And everybody's like, oh, that's normal. Cancer decreases your immune system's ability to fight infections. It's probably like a lung infection, but she went in for testing anyway. And they found out in early December, oh, your cancer has returned and it has metastasized to your lungs and more of your chest. And they tried a couple operations. All this medical stuff happened, basically. But on December 19th, the hospital called our house and basically said, we can no longer cure you. all we can buy you is time. And my mom was like, I am done receiving medical procedures and trying to fight this in a hospital. And so my parents called in hospice, and hospice told us you probably have like 6 weeks to 6 months to say goodbye to her. And then she died in 7 days. And that event was so earth-shattering to me as a 21-year-old. It was like the foundation of my life fell out from under me, but also the rug, and then the floor, and then the center of the earth, and like everything that held my life in place just toppled immediately. And for 3 years, I wandered around in a fog or a haze or a shock aftermath of grief. There was parts of me that tried to address my grief and parts of me that really wanted to push it away and not deal with it. And it really didn't come to surface again until 3 years after my mom died and somebody stole my wallet. And I was so angry that this thing that has, that had such preciousness and meaning to me had been taken from me, just like my mom, which had such preciousness and meaning to me. Like our relationship felt like that weight. And that was the very first moment that I gave myself any sort of permission to grieve, was when I cried over that wallet, but really I was crying for and wailing for my mother. And that language being in my head for the first time, you just gave yourself permission to grieve, is what sparked my interest in researching grief, reading about grief, listening to podcasts about grief, really just educating myself on what grief was. It's not just the month after the funeral. It is so much more. It is so all-encompassing. And then gradually, the very long story short of that is I became a certified grief recovery specialist in 2016. I started my first podcast in 2017 called Coming Back, Talking About Grief. I published my first book, self-published, in 2019. And I was like, does anyone want a book of this? And it turns out a lot of people did. And then Penguin Random House approached me in 2020 to write a daily non-religious guidebook called Your Grief, Your Way. I have hosted many other podcasts since. I've presented at a couple of grief conferences, which has been such a joy. And now my third book called Of Course I'm Here Right Now, which is How to Comfort Grieving People. It's a book for supporters of grievers, friends, family, coworkers, neighbors, practitioners, is coming out later in March. But it really has been almost a decade-long journey of, holy crap, the worst moment of my life transferred into educating myself, becoming what I call a student of grief, and then creating things for other people who are also going through losses of their own to consume and learn from and understand themselves better, and then to share even more widely with the world.
We're going to get into it soon. I got all my
post-its.
I just have to say, in you doing that retelling of your story, it really brought me right back to Permission to Grieve. And I know it's your first book. You look back at it sometimes like, oh, I would write this so different now. But it's amazing. And I've sent it to dozens and dozens and dozens of people. And I think that when you and I met, I already was like a language person. Like, I love words. I was a communications and English major. So how you say things and what you say, like, that's always been of importance to me. But you're the kind of person who really opened my eyes to the impact and importance of words, and also how words and examples or other people's experiences can really shift your entire belief system or understanding, sometimes in like an instant, you know. And even just the name of your first book, Permission to Grieve. And I remember now that moment with your wallet. The permission slip element is something that you and I reference all the time when we just talk to people. I mean, I say, you've got to give yourself the permission to, or people need the permission slip. You know, we talk about that now because you've made that a term and an action and a belief that people can have and apply to their own experiences in their life. And so I'm really excited to dig more into words and all of those details. But let's quickly talk a little bit about some of your successes in growing your grief and coaching business. You have an academy called Lala, Life After Loss. Let's just talk a little bit about your business now, the offerings you have, and a little bit more beyond the books.
Yes, thank you. I tell people that I can work with them in a few different ways, and it kind of depends. There's a whole free quiz on my site if you want to take it, but on what type of grief support you like to receive. And so the quiz is called What's Your Grief Support Style? It's free. It takes 2 minutes. But I have learned through the years that there's four different styles of people. There are people who I call self-checkout style grievers, and they're like, I'm getting in, I'm getting the tools, I'm getting out. I am not interested in help. I'm not interested in a 50-minute Zoom call. I am not interested in other people's feedback or doing grief with others, as I like to call it. And these are people who really enjoy consuming my books, my podcasts, my blogs, like anything that's just on the buffet and available to them. They're like, I want it. Thanks. Bye. And they'll leave lovely reviews. They email me, they contact me, but they're like, I'm interested in doing grief quickly and at my own pace, and I get to choose what happens. Another type of grief support style is called road trip style grievers. And these are people who like to take like a long journey with grief. They want to grow and see themselves evolve through time. But they also, again, kind of like the self-checkout people, they like to choose what the stops are and where and when. And do you take breaks? And do you pause? Do you pursue something relentlessly? Do you take a detour off to the side? This is my wife's style. She is a road trip style griever. And for these people, things like something I offer is called one-on-one grief guidance, which is like 50-minute sessions, but not with any strict schedule. So it's not every Tuesday at 5 p.m. It's like whenever you want to schedule one, you can do it on your own time in your own way. These are also people who love my daily devotional, Your Grief, Your Way, not because they read it every day, but because they play book roulette. They just open it to whatever page, be like, that helps today. And then they go on their way. And these are also people who really appreciate being able to rabbit hole specific topics about their grief. And so I write blogs about why the phrase, I can't imagine what you're going through, isn't helpful. And maybe that's something their grandmother said to them last week. And so they can deep dive on like why it isn't helpful and what to say instead. And they can really have these deeper conversations and reflections with themselves as they navigate grief. The third style is for people who like doing grief with others, but like the self-checkout style grievers want to do it fast. And so these are people who love attending workshops and things like my book party that's coming up, where it's like, it's a 1-hour thing, but there's a bunch of people there. And so you can learn from other people's grief stories at the same time that you are processing your own. And the feedback is often the magic in the room that helps you understand yourself even better and wrap words around what you're going through. So free workshops, often throughout the year, I'll host like book clubs that are short term, like 6-week book clubs around my books, and people join for that. And then the last style is called classroom style grief support. And these are people who want to learn in a classroom setting, but sort of like road trip grievers over the long term. So they want to learn with others over the long term. This is what I created Life After Loss Academy for. Life After Loss Academy is good for all four types. You can get in and get out. You can design your own journey. You can do quick workshops or deep dives or come to weekly grief coaching with me. But especially for people who are classroom style grievers and want to learn over a long time with a lot of people from the ground up in grief. How do I feel safe in the world again? How do I cope with my emotions? How do I fold grief into my life? How do I do grief with others who may or may not be grieving, friends, family, coworkers? And how do I cultivate a sense of peace and purpose and hope again? These are people who really excel in Life After Loss Academy, because in the same way they can take notes and watch the videos and do things on their own time, they can also bring things to the group to sort of chew on and then take them back and process again. And so there is no exact recommended tool for each of the grief support styles. You can really do whatever you want all the time, which is kind of my belief of most people in life. If you're not hurting anybody else, like, do whatever you want. But Life After Loss Academy, which I founded in January of 2020, which was very fortuitous because a lot of grief support went online at that time, has truly been the cornerstone of my work ever since then. So going on 6 years now, and we're getting very close to having 100 students in there, which is really something I'm very, very proud of. There's people who've been with me since 2020 and kind of just continue to exist in the community. They bring old losses back to the surface when big milestones appear, their child graduates, or they get remarried, or someone else in their life has a baby and that activates their grief, or they find out new information about old losses, such as a family secret that is unveiled, or they are managing the finances for a loved one and something comes to the woodwork, or they find out an ex did something before the divorce and then there's something there to re-grieve. And then there's people who join 3 months, 3 years, even 30 years after major losses and come saying, I have not ever had a space or an opportunity to process my grief. I've been through a lot of, pardon me, shit, but I haven't had a space where it's appropriate to talk about it and keep talking about it. And that is the space on the internet, in the world, that Life After Loss Academy occupies. One of my greatest successes and the thing I'm so proud of.
Well, it's so powerful. And I remember when you first started working on it, even just to put all of your concepts and ideas into a like consumable thing that you can engage with was amazing. But then the community that it's built and the amount of people that you can learn from, connect with, it really is such a special and powerful place. And so I'm glad that it still allows people to access it at different like layers. And that was something that I really learned from you in the early days of our friendship was, you know, of course, people when they're grieving have all different kinds of capacity to digest things. So some people do like to read. Some people cannot read at all when they're going through grief. So maybe they need to listen to something. And over the many, many years, you clearly have built a huge Rolodex of all different resources in all different mediums. So it's awesome that people can access your work and use it all throughout the journey and the stages that they're going through.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things too. And the cool part about it and what I tell like new business owners is you think you will know who you are and what you're building in the first 2-3 years of your business. After about the 4-5 year mark, your audience will tell you what you are to them. And that is how you continue to hone and refine your work. I know I'm not here necessarily to get business advice, but the first few years of it being in my grief business, I thought my purpose was to guide people through grief. And that is a lot of what I do, similar to how a therapist or a spiritual worker or someone who helps people process emotional or heart pain does. But over and over again, especially in the last 5 to 7 years of being in business, people have said, you have helped me put words to my grief. You have helped me find language for something I thought was wordless. You have helped me help other people in my life understand what I'm going through because now I have the language to bring them. And so, especially with my new book coming out, I'm like, what I specialize in is grief, but underneath that, what I really specialize in is the words about grief. And so I just keep, people talk about niching down all the time. And I'm almost like, don't niche down at the beginning, unless you really want to. But like, start with a big or broad audience, and then you will slowly understand or know, or people will tell you what you are the best at within this field. Because you can get grief coaching from thousands of people in the world. You can search grief coach or grief therapist online and find lots and lots of people who do things similar to what I do. But once people are in my orbit, they're like, oh, this is the gift that she uniquely offers, or this is the service that I can uniquely expect from working with Shelby when it comes to grief.
Absolutely. And you can definitely give business advice. We have a lot of entrepreneur listeners or people that are thinking about entrepreneurship. So we love all the business advice sprinkled throughout. It's great. Okay. I want to talk before we get into, of course, I'm here right now. I want to talk a little bit about these very big pivot points that I know you've had in your life just from being close friends. Obviously, the loss of your mom and all of those health events that you were going through with both of your parents, those were huge and impactful. But since then, you've also had many more things that have happened that have, I don't want to say deeper impacted, but in a very different way, shifted how you show up in the world. And I think each one of them has almost like layered on top of the other one and built a different understanding or approach that you then share with the people in your life in a way that's like helpful for them to move through it. But I want to talk about like before you kind of had gotten over some of these events. And to me, the first one that I think of after you had your business and you were running and doing things full steam ahead was your health event. And I mean, I want you to describe it however you want to, but as your friend, I wasn't sure if anything was going to be normal for you after that. And the fact that you're even doing grief work still sometimes is like shocking to me. I mean, I won't think about it for a while and then I'll think about it. And it's pretty wild. So as much as you're comfortable sharing, take us back to that health event that you had a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. There's two big things I know that we'll talk about in this. The first one, and each one kind of has a lesson with it. So we'll do the seizure and the lesson with it. And then the other one that I know we've got in the docket, but yes. And I'm coming up on the 5-year anniversary now of I had a seizure unexpectedly with like almost no legible call. Like I could have never seen it coming. I did not have a pre-diagnosis. I was not prone to seizures. Like this is not a thing that I knew to expect in my life. And like a perfect storm of events happened where I had gotten some treatment from a healthcare professional. I had traveled recently to see family and I had gotten like some version of the flu. Like I was just like super dehydrated. and essentially had a seizure because the salt in my body had gotten so low that my body was like, turn it off and turn it back on again because this is not working. And I had this seizure at like 2 or 3 in the morning. I had texted a friend the day before saying, I do not feel well. They had taken me to an urgent care the previous day. And when they didn't hear from me, they were a nurse. They're like, we got to go over there and check on her. And so they came to my house. I didn't answer the door. I was not answering the phone. I wasn't answering texts. They heard my cat calling out in distress. And they were like, we're breaking the door down. And so they broke the door down to my apartment and found me unconscious in my bed. There was vomit everywhere. And they were like, we got to get her to a hospital. And so I was presumably put into an ambulance. I have no idea. I was not conscious for any of this. And it was also during COVID. It was 2021 when this happened. And they were like, we have her in the hospital now. We sense she has a sodium deficiency. And so they put me on like IV drips and we're trying to get my brain back to baseline so that I could turn me back on. And they're like, one person can stay with her because COVID lockdowns and restrictions, like you can't have people floating in and out of here because we don't want to spread the virus in a hospital where there are a lot of people. And 3 days after I was admitted to the hospital, I remember waking up and the first thing I remember thinking is like, I think I still have contacts in my eyes. And then I saw my friend sitting in a chair next to the hospital bed working on her laptop. And God bless her for having the ability to work from home. I looked at her and said, am I dreaming? And she goes, no. And that's when I knew something awful had happened. And I'm not entirely sure like chemically or biologically how the seizure worked exactly, but I lost access to portions of my brain that were previously like functioning fine. That doctor at one point came in and asked me for my social security number. And all I could repeat was my childhood home phone number that my mom made me memorize with a song. I also remember, and my wife likes to tell the story because she and I had just started talking at the time. We were not an item yet. She likes to tell the story of my phone was charged. And so I looked in my inbox for my text messages and I saw you and I saw a couple of my other friends and my brain knew, I was like, I know these people. I don't know how I know them, but I know that I like them. And then I was in a job that I didn't really like at the time. And my manager from that job had texted me and I was like, I don't like them. I didn't know who they were. I didn't know why they were texting me, but I knew I was like, I don't like this person. I don't like they're in my life. And I remember seeing my wife's face in my phone because we had just swapped like phone information. We'd stopped talking on Instagram and moved to the phone. And I was like, I don't know who that is, but I know I really like them. And I had this, I don't know if you've read, I'm not going to remember the name of the author. It's a beautiful book by a brain scientist who has a stroke and she like witnesses herself having a stroke as she's having it. It's called My Stroke of Insight. It was like the left hemisphere of my brain that was analytical and had data and words and information shut off. And all I knew was what I felt. And through the next like week or so that I spent in the hospital, like my brain slowly came back online. But one of my first fears is like, I have clients. I have a grief business aside of the other job I was working as well. And I had no idea how to manage that. I'd never had such a personal emergency before. And I'm a one woman show. I was like, how do I respond to people who are flooding my inbox, asking where I am, ghosting on clients, all this other stuff. And the biggest lesson I learned from this in the weeks and months and even the years that have followed is that especially in the industry that I'm in, which is grief work, death work, end of life work, terminal illness work, just kind of like life or death for a lot of people, is that the thing that my audience wants the most from me, besides the tools and the words and the language to heal and the books and the podcasts and whatever, is they want me to be well. And I don't know that that's true for every industry in the world, but grievers as a population are some of the kindest and most understanding and like honestly merciful people I have ever met. I sent emails out about a week after I got home from the hospital saying, I'm so sorry I dropped the ball. I had a medical emergency. I had nothing. And the amount of, oh my gosh, I hope you're okay. I'll be thinking of you. Let's circle back and reschedule in like a month. Like the grace that people gave me in my business and in my work, the podcast went off the rails for however long it went off, was truly astounding to me. And now when I'm in seasons of stress or an inability to juggle multiple jobs, or my wife's a Canadian citizen. She immigrated to the United States from Canada after we got married, going through that process and just not having a lot of time to do everything I really want to do, or I feel like I should be delivering to this audience. I put myself back in the shoes of the people that poured so much grace out onto me after that life event. And I was like, they would want me to be well. And sometimes that's the difference between me getting back on my computer and staying online until 11 p.m. doing grief work or putting things online or writing blog posts or whatever it is that I'm doing and going to bed. or working on embroidery or going to the beach for a walk. Like, it's the difference between me taking care of myself a lot of the time and driving myself to hustle more. And so that was one of the, I didn't expect to learn a lesson from that event. I didn't go into it being like, I'm going to learn a lesson from this, because that's not how grief events work in your life. But it was one of those things that came as like a blessing of that experience. And so now whenever I'm stressed out about being able to deliver something on my timeline and to my expectations because of what I think that they think, I'm like, no, my audience is the kind of people who thinks ultimately I want her to be well. And that is such a gift, that pivot point, that turning point offered me in my work. I've definitely slowed down in a lot of ways.
Oh yeah. And I think you're absolutely right that is maybe more prevalent or, more supportive in your community or network because they maybe understand. But I do feel like when you share and you're going through something and you need to pause or step back, people are a lot more understanding than we all think. And sometimes it's like, if you can think for yourself, what if someone that you're working with said to you, XYZ happened to me, I need to delay, you would never be upset. I mean, it's very rare that would be something that would cause you to be mad at someone. Like, they have to take care of themselves, you know? But we all feel like the value or the importance sometimes is different than it is until something serious happens that we have no control over. Like, the choice to be in the hospital or not was not really yours, but it taught you that people adjusted and wanted you to be well. And I think sometimes when you get that validation through lived experience that maybe you're not choosing, you know, in the future that you can pull back or delay or let people know that you need that space. And when you haven't experienced it yet, you don't know, but everyone should try if they're worried about it, because you would react similarly if someone in your life said, I need to pause or pull back because I'm not okay. So I'm really glad that you shared that. And I also feel like, tell me if you agree with this or not, but in pulling back and not always pushing to these expectations you have of yourself, or like needing to do things that balance you, you've been able to prioritize and spend times on things that are better for the business, or make more conscious decisions about your time in a way that positively come back, right? Like, maybe you're not spending as much time doing grief work, but you're spending your time on stuff that's more aligned.
Right. And there's also, even more than things that are like good for the business, I'm talking like from a bottom line or financial perspective, what does come out of that allowing yourself to be human and not forcing yourself to be a constantly producing robot, and not even allowing yourself to be human sometimes, but admitting your humanity. Like, oh crap, I landed in the hospital and couldn't take care of that for you. Is there has been such a deeper connection to the people that I am serving. And I'll kind of turn this around onto other businesses that I admire, but I'm thinking specifically, there is a lovely stationery store and like gift shop here in Chicago where I live. And I believe it's one of their owners died recently within the last year or so. And they shut down the store for a period of time to create and attend a memorial for him. But then also across their social media on like different days through the year, they'll have like in-store pop-ups or social media posts that honor his memory and his legacy and everything that he contributed to the business. And I feel so much more connected to this entity as a business in the world, because they openly honor and share their humanity. It's not just like, and I'm going to demonize corporations for a second, but it's not just like a corporation posting an obituary of like a higher up exec or something like that and be like, we mourn their loss, RIP, this is the legacy they leave, but actually interweaving and like folding their humanity and the loss and their grief into how they do business. And when I think of that, I'm like, I can do that in my business too. Not only is it the industry I'm in, so there's much more permission to do that, but like when I do that, I can reflect back that it's okay for other business owners, especially one person entrepreneur businesses, to do the same. So whether you're selling cupcakes or flowers or coffee, like you can absolutely fold your humanity into your business at every turn. And I think in this, the year of our Lord 2026, so many people are understanding that, I know authenticity is such a buzzword, but really humanity is what makes businesses go. We can AI all we want, but it's not going to help us feel more connected to the places that we frequent and the causes and the people ultimately that we want to support.
Absolutely. Okay. So one thing that is like a detail that's sort of important in my mind is you've spent most of your life living in Chicago, but this health event happened when you were living in Washington State, and the friend that was in the hospital room when you woke up was Tammy, who I had the very good pleasure of knowing as well. And she became the one keeping the rest of us in the loop of what was going on and, you know, making sure that you were okay in your transition out of the hospital. And yeah, that was just a wild time where you were far away from so many of us who wanted to, you know, be there and support you. And that was its own journey. But I guess the main reason I'm bringing it up is because the next big thing that knocked you sideways after you recovered from this physical event was another significant loss in your life. Can you just share with us what happened next?
Yeah. I mean, a little over a year, I guess, after I had the seizure, Tammy was the person to receive me when I was released from the hospital and I moved back to Chicago. She was like, "You're coming home." I was like, "Okay." Because when your best friend who's known you for a decade says something like that to you, I'm like, "Okay." I had moved out. This is a sidebar, but I had moved out to Washington State because I'd had this like intuitive dream basically of like, you need to go to the West Coast. You're either going to go to grad school or meet the love of your life. I got rejected from grad school because they're like, "You published 2 books already. You're doing this backwards." And I instead did end up meeting my wife there at the Canadian border between Washington and Canada. So I was like, okay, good. I got my wife now. I can go home. And I moved back to Chicago at my friend's behest. But also I learned, I'm like, West Coast living is not for me for the long term. And I had moved back to Chicago. I'd started like running with Tammy. I'd had routines and things again. And my brain was back online for the most part. And COVID was still happening. And so there was a lot that was locked down and just a lot of ways in which the world was small and different. And Tammy was such a significant part of my community. And I'm talking about her in the past tense because she got COVID in late April of 2022. And that combined with a bunch of other factors about her health and her life ended in her dying May 13th of 2022. And she was 29. It was a loss that absolutely no one in my friend group, her family, any of us ever saw coming. And very similar to my mom's death, it's like, yeah, we got 7 days notice, but that was nothing. With Tammy's death, it was also like a blindsiding grief event. It was not a terminal diagnosis or something where it's like you get a long decline. And I don't ever want to compare griefs. I think they're equally bad. It is one thing to suffer for a long time and then die. It is another to be split open by pain, a moment's notice. And that's exactly what happened. And she is and was my very best friend in the world. Like I have not, there has not been anyone or anything, and I don't know that I want them to, but who has like rushed in to fill that space even now, like 4 years after her death. And that one was a harder one to glean lessons from because and my first response often to loss in my own life is rage. And my first response to her death was not, "I'm about to make some meaning out of this." It was, "Fuck the universe. Fuck people who choose not to mask in public. Fuck people who don't understand what this is like. And honestly, fuck people who laugh at my pain and for sharing this grief." And it took me a while, and it's actually taken this conversation a little bit to reflect back on it. I was like, was there a lesson I learned from that? Because that shifted my life, not my business so much, but it shifted my life in such a way. But what I did recognize from the get-go with her death is that was the first time that I gave myself permission to grieve right away. Like with my mother's death, I was trying to tamp that thing down, shove it in the basement, like not let grief be a big major part of my life. But now I was like, grief is not only my identity, it is my business, it is my practice in the world. I'm continually a student of grief. And I was like, I hate that grief is coming to me like this. I am not enjoying what is being served up at this buffet. And also, I am giving myself permission to process it, feel it, let it change my identity, let it change my behavior. And the biggest example I have of that is when my mom died, by and large, with the exception of a few like scattered relatives, the first few years after her death, I grieved alone. I grieved by myself in my apartment, watching YouTube videos about how to get through grief and researching myself. It became my hyperfixation project. With Tammy's death, that was the first time when I felt like I was not just grieving by myself, but I was calling other people in to grieve with me. I was creating rituals and ceremonies and releases and all these other things that paid homage to her. And people could participate or not participate. This was not like, you need to come and grieve with me or else. But we, a small group of her friends, gathered at a pier in our neighborhood like 3 days after she died. Like, it was very close to the time when she died. And I remember telling everyone, I was like, this is a thing I like to do when I'm grieving. You can join if you want. You can sit back if you want. Either is fine with me. But I said, I just need to yell and I need to scream because that is like my doorway to crying. And I remember everyone was in, everyone was game for it. This is a group of 30-year-old women and queer people, just like at the end of a pier in Chicago in the end of May. And we all joined hands and just like let out the most guttural wail, like at the lake, and just let Lake Michigan hold all of our pain. And it was the first time that I had done that in front of anyone and with anyone. And my friends came up to me afterwards. Of course, we were all hugging and crying and missing her fiercely. And they were like, I didn't know I needed that. I didn't know I needed this. Not just grieving, which like, yes, not just screaming, yes, but also doing this with other people who feel the same way and are mourning the same person. And that in and of itself was a kind of doorway to giving myself permission to grieve with other people. I think as the years have gone on, I share less about my mom and less about my best friend online, like through my business. I tell stories about them and things on my podcast, but less like picture posts of them, partially because I want to protect and preserve their memories, partially because people are trolls are on the internet and they say things like, I can't believe you're using their death just for attention, which is like, that's not why I'm doing it. But partially too, because I feel like I'm in such a different place with both of them relationally, where I'm like, I see and talk to Tammy all the time. I see and talk to my mom all the time. I have folded them into my life in such a way where it's, I don't necessarily need to be talking about how I'm doing that as much as I enjoy talking about like, here's how a client did it, or here's, you know, something about my book coming out, or here's another way to look at grief that maybe you haven't considered. And so I've almost zoomed out from my own losses to encompass all that is grief. And I don't know if that's a bad thing or a good thing. People still really appreciate and enjoy when I talk about my own personal losses. I think either people don't know me and that's the first time they hear of it, or they're like, Shelby's still grieving too. Like, I am not some grief practitioner up on a high throne being like, here's how to grieve. I'm like, no, there are still seasons and days and months of the year where I'm in the trenches of loss. And I'm using the same tools and language and words that I teach to cope with my own grief. And then it becomes this really beautiful cycle of, I need it today, you need it tomorrow, we need it together. Like, we're just kind of hand off the tool, hand it back. Yeah, it's cyclical and beautiful that way.
Well, and I don't want to place a value on if you should or shouldn't share more or less. But I do want to acknowledge the fact that I remember when you were getting that feedback from other people. And I don't think that you stopped or shared less because they were saying you're using this. I think it was a little bit more about preserving what was yours and keeping some of that for yourself. And you didn't stop doing it when people said you're doing this for the wrong reasons, because one, it was helping you and it felt good. And it felt like the thing that you wanted to do to express the period. And it showed and gave permission to so many people to talk about their losses or their person who's no longer here. And I think culturally, directly or indirectly, we're told not to do that sometimes. Like, I even remember having a friend one time when we were younger tell me about a new friend we were making that their mom had passed and they weren't, you know, living with a mom for over 5 years at this point, but that I shouldn't bring it up. And in my head, I'm like, the next time I'm alone with this girl, I'm bringing it up. Like, I'm not going to ask her at the bar with like 20 people, but the next time we're alone, I'm bringing it up. And That's just like my personality. And then I learned over time as I grew older that that's actually an amazing thing to do. Like, you're never going to remind someone of their loss. They're probably already thinking about it, but asking them about that person can feel so good. And maybe they don't want to talk about that person in the moment of whatever exchange, but I think you sharing publicly how you were feeling, what you were missing, everything you were experiencing gave other people the space to do that. And whether it's a post honoring someone or something they lost, or a little like memorial, you know, or a memoriam, like a little thing that you use to honor them. And you've honored Tammy in so many beautiful ways. I love visiting her tree and her bench. And I'm one of those people that looks all around me for the people that are no longer here physically with me. So I really love that you did that. And I don't think that the fact that you're not doing it constantly anymore means you decided not to do it because people shared that feedback. I think you consciously over time made a change, but didn't stop sharing because people told you not to. You knew that that's coming from a place of other people not having the space to feel validated in their loss. That's not coming from a place where it's better for all of us to not talk about our loss, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. Well, and that reflects back something I teach too, which is like, even if they're not talking about it, they're still thinking about it.
100%.
They're still remembering it. It's still informing how they live.
100%.
And work and exist.
Yeah. Okay. We need to get to this because here's the deal. Not only is this coming out in a few weeks and everyone can already pre-order, we'll put the link in the show notes. It's for people who are supporting grievers. But in my opinion, if you're supporting a griever or you're existing on this earth, you're grieving something. And I think this book is valuable because it gives us language to start conversations, to better understand conversations, better show up in conversations. We don't need to give the whole framework away because people really need to digest it on their own. But let's walk people through. Of course, I'm here right now, this current project of yours, and give them a little taste and flavor of what the book has in store.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you for the space to share it. And this is like, I have a friend who started off as a client, but now is a friend who lives here in Chicago. And she's like, your first book was to see if you could write a book. And I think that's correct. That's a fair judgment. My second book was a commissioned project from a publishing house that was like, we need someone to write in this format. And we think you're the person. I'm glad to say they were correct. And that's how that second book came about. But this third one is truly something that I have invented that is helping me and my clients and like perfect strangers know what to say to comfort someone who is grieving or find comfort when they themselves are grieving. And it is so simple and it is incredibly life-changing. And it came from this question of, what do I say to comfort someone who's grieving? But then there's all this stuff underneath it. There's an author and like business guy named Donald Miller who talks about people have three different motivations when looking to solve a problem in the world. They have internal motivations, they have external motivations, and then they have global motivations or conflicts. So things that they're wrestling with internally, externally, and then on a world level. And internally, everyone wants to be perceived as a good friend or a good person, especially when someone else is in crisis. Externally, people want the script. They want the words, the tools to say to comfort someone who's grieving. They're just like, give me the words so I can say them back. Let me do this ritual or this support, heavy air quotes, but correctly. I want to do this well. And then the global issue or the global motivation is I want to live in a world where everyone is able to comfort someone who is grieving. And it's not just everything happens for a reason, or God just needs another angel, or you think that's bad. I had to grieve uphill in the snow both ways during the war, and like all this other comparison garbage or like toxic positivity. People genuinely want to know for those three reasons. They want to be perceived as a good friend or a good person. They want to know what to say, and they want to live in a world where people know what to say in the midst of suffering, because we all want to be comforted when we're suffering too. And I approach the book from that place, is how do I solve these three problems all at one time? And the phrases, of course, I'm here and right now. There's three different phrases. They're outlined in the book. I show you when and how to use them and different alternatives for them. Things for corporate settings, things for if you're a grief professional working with clients, things for if you're a friend or family member, and then things if you're a griever also supporting other grieving people. Because it's very rare that grief happens in a vacuum. If like a husband dies, a grieving mother may also be supporting her children, for instance, or his siblings or something of that nature. You're often supporting people who are grieving. And it is really a, gosh, how do I say this? It's a little magical. It's a missive. It's my soapbox on why words are the key to unlocking good grief support. Because time and again, the biggest secondary loss that grievers say after the death, after the divorce, after the diagnosis, the second biggest thing they lose is their relationships and their friendships. And the number one reason they lose those is because people say shitty stuff or they disappear at all after a major loss. They say things like, I'm so sorry for your loss, my condolences, then they never show up again. Or they say something like, you just need to get busy, time heals all, or you need to be strong for your family, or God never gives you more than you can handle. Like, people are just coding grievers in platitudes and cliches. And it may be your meaning of the world, but it may not be a griever's meaning of the world. And even that, it's not for you to like gloss over their pain that way. And so these are three phrases that without fail, in more than 8 years now, 10 years going on 10 years of supporting grieving people through one-on-one sessions, through group coaching, through workshops, I'm like, these three phrases work and they keep working. They're non-denominational. They're short. You can pull them out at any time. And then the last thing I'll say before your next question is the best part about this is that words are free. Everyone after a loss is like, what do I do? What do I do to support someone who's grieving? And they send flowers and they do DoorDash gift cards and they might offer to come over and vacuum or babysit the dog or run the kids to carpool or get the mail or water the plants. And these are all actions. And all of those things will cost you time, money, energy, potentially things you do not have to give in this season. And also they require proximity. They need you to be there in order to give them. And what COVID taught us, and this is where I draw inspiration from Tammy's death, is that we need a grief support tool that allows us to offer comfort across time and space, but also with not a lot of time or energy. And words are the key. So you can say these phrases over text message, over FaceTime, over email, over Zoom, over the phone, in person. However you're already communicating with somebody who's grieving is how these phrases can show up. And every single time without fail, they help. And they do not deny a grieving person's reality. They do not paint your meaning over it instead of theirs. And they really give, kind of subtly, I never mentioned this once in the book, but that permission to grieve that I wrote about all the way back in 2019.
Absolutely. I'm so excited for people to read this and get their hands on this. Let's share a little bit more before we make everyone have to go check it out themselves. The start of the book does such a good job explaining these narratives that people going through grief are telling themselves, or the state that they're in, the place that they're in when they're navigating grief, so that you as the supporter know how to show up for them. Can you walk us through those different stories that people in grief are telling themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. Through now more than almost a decade of coaching people through grief, I've noticed that everyone, regardless of what they're grieving or how long it's been, or even the type of loss, are telling themselves one or more of the same three stories. They all narrow down to the same thing over and over again. They're like records on repeat. They are, I'm crazy, I'm alone, and it will be like this forever. And I go into detail in the book about like why we tell ourselves those stories. Sometimes it's society. A lot of times it's society. Sometimes it's like our own expectations of how we think grief should go. And sometimes it's things we've learned from other people or maybe even the media about like what grief is supposed to look like. So you can read more of that in the book. But consistently, the things that unlock or shift or change those stories for grieving people is not you contradicting them. You're not crazy. You're not alone. It won't be like this forever, because that butts up against their lived reality. They don't believe you because they can't see it for themselves. It is to validate their pain. Of course, you're feeling sad. Your dad's still dead. By coming alongside them, even if I don't understand, I'm here for you. I have not forgotten that you're grieving. And then to offer context surrounding time. Right now, I can totally see how hope feels far away. And that's it. That's how you accompany someone in grief. So regardless of whether you even know the story a grieving person is telling, because they're not going to outright come and tell you, they might, but not often will people be like, I feel so crazy, or I feel so alone, or I can't see a way out of this. Like, people, grieving people don't often say that right away, especially if you're like a coworker or professional, like a medical professional or a grief professional. But they will give you signs that these stories are informing their reality. And even if they don't, chances are they are, because every single grieving person I've worked with, and myself when I was grieving my mom, and again with Tammy, and all the other losses that I've had in my life, these are stories I've told myself too, is I'm crazy. No one else feels this way. No one gets how I feel. If people knew what I really felt, I would be cast out of my group, or whatever it is. I'm alone, even in a crowded room. I'm by myself. No one gets how I feel. And then it will be like this forever, or I can't see a way out, or I'm stuck in my grief. Everyone's telling themselves some version of these big three stories. And these three phrases consistently, of course, validation. I'm here, accompaniment, and right now, context of time or time anchoring. These are the things that help gradually get people out of telling themselves these stories. And even if that's not your goal, they are comforting regardless.
Yes. And what I love the most about the book is you walk us through the framework of these things that they're feeling, these phrases that can unlock them or, you know, show up to better support them. And then you give all these versions of the phrases and examples and context, because it does slightly depend on the circumstance of whoever you're supporting or what you're going through supporting yourself. And so if you've ever been wondering what to say, what not to say, this book walks through all of it. It makes it easy to understand, easy to implement, but also gives you a variety of versions of these phrases, ways you can show up, and suggestions for how to support people better. And I'm just so excited for it to get out into the world. Let's tell everyone, like, where should they go to pre-order? Where can they find all of your work? Give us the rundown of where people can stay in touch with you and get more of what you do.
Yeah, I often joke, I know this is not a grief show, but I joke that grieving brains can't hold a whole lot of information. And so literally everything I do is at shelbyforsythia.com. So if you remember nothing else from this conversation, it's just myname.com. If you have a little bit more brain capacity to hold more, Of Course I'm Here Right Now is available from Amazon, Bookshop, Barnes and Noble. You can pre-order it at your local indie bookstore. You can ask them, you can show them a cover of the book or the ISBN number, and they'll pre-order and bring it into the store. A lot of local bookstores will mail things to you as well. So figure out what yours does, because we love supporting indie around here. And then if you are, regardless of where in the world you are, I'm hosting a launch party the day the book comes out on March 31st. It is free to attend. And whether or not you've bought the book, you will hear me read some excerpts from the book, teach the framework. We'll talk about your specific life and like things to say or not say to someone who's grieving. And if you're in Chicago on March 30th, so the eve before the book comes out, if you want the book before the rest of the world gets its hands on it, you can come celebrate with me at a theater on the North Side. And Emily is my co-host for the evening. So we'll turn the tables once again. And have Emily interviewing me about the book in an even deeper context.
I can't wait. It's going to be amazing. And I can't wait to send this to people I know. I mean, that's the best about your work, is there's always something tactical that you can take right away and apply to your life or someone that you're supporting. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing your own journey and providing all these resources for other people to better show up for themselves and the people that they love.
Yes, thank you so much. I love just the concept of success rewritten, and grieving in its own way is about rewriting what success looks like. So it feels so, so aligned to have been here today.
Thank you, Shelby. I love you.
Love you too.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Be sure to subscribe to this YouTube channel or on whatever listening platform you're using. And like, rate, and review the episode. It's also super helpful if you share it with a friend. If you want to check out Shelby's work, go to shelbyforsythia.com. You can also follow Shelby on social media. You can check out her workshops and see all of the books she's written, including the book we covered today, Of Course I'm Here Right Now. If you want to get in touch with me, go to successrewrittenshow.com or email Emily at successrewrittenshow.com. We'll see you next time.